Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
And today, we've reached the end of the line, Brian. We've watched every single film from 2007.
Every one.
Every single last one, or at least the ones that matter and that we could get our hands on and that had a filter.
That does narrow things down sometimes.
Yeah. So this is when we look back and we try to put some order to the chaos. We try to kind of put all of these in coherent order and rank them. And this year, to me anyway, that feat seems impossible. So in 2007, the nominees for Best Picture were Michael Clayton, Juno, Atonement, There Will Be Blood, and the year's big winner, No Country for Old Men.
Coming up in our finale episode of 07, we will reorder the Oscars top five. We will ask questions, talk trivia, the grand reveal, our own personal top fives, maybe slash top tens, and then we'll inform our dear readers where else the Oscars should be kicked. By the way, this year, every time, you know, it's like, it takes some prep to do this podcast. Have you noticed that?
Oh yeah. It takes some prep.
You gotta divert your movie watching energies back in time 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Sometimes that is not always the first choice.
It isn't.
But every year I kind of think, okay, I'm gonna keep it a little tighter. I'm just going to go with like maybe 12, 15 movies, try to guess that those are probably the best candidates anyway, and then choose my top 5 to 10 from that. And this year, once again, I kind of failed because I got through 24 movies for this year.
Yeah.
And it's just tough to kick some out because sometimes you get these surprises. And I always try to, anything that is nominated for any of the big awards, I want to at least watch it so I can, again, do the Oscar kick, you know. So, for example, Lars and the Real Girl. So nominated for original screenplay. I love that category.
You're a big screenplay guy.
I love the screenplay category. And In the Valley of Elah, Tommy Lee Jones is nominated for Best Actor. So I tracked it down and watched it. Neither one made anywhere near my top list. But if you're trying to get, you know, do that, the list balloons, and then you're always throwing in like, oh, but we gotta watch Bug. Oh, we gotta watch The Mist. Oh, yeah. You gotta put The Orphanage on your queue.
And I'm so right every time. That's the crazy thing. I have a 100% accuracy rate with the you have to watches.
No, not every time, but there have been some, you know, definitely big wins.
Because you want to be comprehensive. You know, if you're going to be making a top five or top 10, you can't just watch 12 or 15 movies.
I know.
You know, you have to really get your hands dirty in there. We usually watch around 30.
Yeah.
And then plus there's a ton other from the year that I've seen before that I know, like, I didn't really like that much, or that's definitely not a contender. I won't watch it again.
But what about Eastern Promises?
I know. Yeah, that was one I'd seen before.
I thought
was a huge fan of.
Yeah, I thought you told me when I put it on my list, you were kind of like, well, it's no History of Violence.
Yeah, yeah. I think I was blinded by how much I love History of Violence. Yeah. And then looking back at my letterbox, I was like, wow, I kind of loved this movie too, Eastern Promises, and never got around to it. Yep. So it's one of those that I have regrets, Brian, and I'm okay admitting that on this show.
Well, someday you'll be able to do a decade list. It's not that far away.
It's
we got
not,
08 and 09 coming up.
Oh, God.
And then we'll have a decade episode.
09 is when they open it up, though, right? And that's it's going to be a project.
9 or 10 of them.
So at some point, I will watch Eastern Promises, and then I'll have to revisit this list and figure out, is there a way to,
you can do
to
it
squeeze
in your,
it in?
You can do it in your David Cronenberg marathon that, sadly, you'll have to do all by yourself because hardly any of them have filters, and they all need them badly.
Many do,
So let's start with reordering the top five.
So I think for both of us, this is going to be a spoiler of our personal top fives, right?
Because the Oscars got some pretty good ones in their top five.
Yeah. And there are two clear standouts here. So much so that I don't think...
I thought you were like not as high on either one of these as I am.
I'll say this, that compared to the other years where the movies that were in my one and two were ones that I was like super enthusiastic about and I loved unabashedly. Mm-hmm. And this year, they're ones that I love, but I have complicated relationships
with. They're not personal as much as some of the other ones. Like Mulholland Drive, that was a personal number
that's one of my top five all time.
So these are not in your personal favorites of all time, but it's still a big year. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Because are these movies that you sort of more admire as being great as opposed to you love?
Yes, but I'll say that maybe my 6 through 10 are all movies that I, at one point in my life anyway, gentlemen's five-star movies. I loved them. And then on the rewatch...
A gentleman's five-star,
you know, just for gentlemen.
What does that mean?
You know, it's a high-class five-star. It's a five-star that drinks a martini.
As opposed to what?
I don't know. A down and dirty...
A down and dirty five-star? Is there such a thing?
I guess you have the stone cold five-stars. Those are the masterpieces, the no doubters. Mm. And then you have the gentleman's five-stars. Like, I'll give it to
them. That's called a four.
Perhaps. This year, I think to me, they're almost all 4.5s, where they're really? Very close to movies that I love, but in each case, there's kind of something about it that was back. A little wrinkle that made me say, I don't know if this is one of my all-timers.
Yeah, interesting.
So I think with this list anyway, with R1 and 2, it's going to be pretty obvious that they're going to be one of two movies that the Oscars nominated. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think that this year it was a question of like, what movie's going to win the Best Picture? I think it was more like, which of those two are going to win Best Picture? So let's hear your, reorder the Academy's top five.
So number five, Juno.
Yep, same.
Sorry, Juno.
I have a feeling we're going to clash on the next one though.
My next one is Michael Clayton. Which I loved, but Atonement I loved even more because that just shows how much I loved Atonement because I do really like Michael Clayton.
Yeah, I think we're flipped there. Yeah, I have Michael Clayton as much. I have Atonement and then I have Michael Clayton as my three, but I do think that Atonement is the more sort of, I don't know, technically sophisticated of the two.
And then There Will Be Blood versus No Country for Old Men. I mean, these are really like 1A, 1B, tied for one, essentially for me. But if I have to say, like, which one do I like? Which one was I the most giddy about watching again? Like, I've been marking down 07 since the beginning of this show. Like, I'm looking forward to 07 because of... There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men. So then and Atonement. But when I got closer and I was like, I'm ready to watch it, I was more excited about No Country for Old Men when I actually sat down to watch it. And I actually, it rose in my estimation this time, even further. Mm-hmm. And There Will Be Blood was already way up there. But I guess this time around, I will give the nod to No Country for Old Men. It could be that in another year or two, if I rewatch either one of them, they could very well flip. You know, they're that close. But No Country, I think the Oscars got it right as the number one Best Picture winner.
I thought you would go that way, and I went the other way.
Really?
I have No Country, and then There Will Be Blood. But what you said about the
There Will Be Blood as number one.
As my number one, Rising in your estimation. Mm-hmm. I think that was a recurring theme for me this year. The movies that, because I'd seen all of these before, the ones that on rewatch, I didn't feel like they hit as hard or I had more problems with, I pushed them down a little bit, but the ones that I kind of had that revelation on the second watch where the light bulb went on, I think those are the ones that stuck a little more and are going to be in my top five. And There Will Be Blood was definitely one that the first time around, I just think I didn't know what to make of it.
Yeah,
it just kind of was... I don't know. It was a blob in my hands and I couldn't really mold it into something that made sense to me. But this time, the things that were challenging, I kind of saw more as like the weird genius of the movie rather than, I don't know, choices that didn't land quite right.
I agree. I mean, I have pretty much nothing bad to say about There Will Be Blood. I mean, the one of the things there's a little more, I know we had a little fight about this, whether it was funny or not, but there is some more humor, you know, Woody Harrelson, you know, anytime you throw Woody Harrelson in there, it's like, what was the purpose of that?
The Tommy Lee Jones, a little bit of funny. Assistant.
Wendell, that guy is ridiculous.
The deputy. Oh, Sheriff. Yeah. After we had that conversation the day after, I just kept saying around the house, oh, Sheriff, we just missed him. So I guess it is a little funnier than I thought it was at first.
And how dangerous is Anton Chigurh compared to what, the bubonic plague? You know, he's just, he's really funny. And that part of it makes me feel like it's more enjoyable to watch it. Hmm. There Will Be Blood is a harder watch.
It is, yeah.
In a lot of ways, because it's just more relentless. But I think that Daniel Day-Lewis's acting performance is not just the best of the year, but the best in a long time on either side of 2007. I just, you know, this is like his masterpiece, you know, genius movie. So, I admire in some ways the art of There Will Be Blood more. I certainly do. I do. I admire it more than No Country for Old Men. But which one is kind of my personal favorite? I'd say No Country.
Hmm. Fair enough. Can't argue with that.
Mm-hmm. So, however, neither one of them, I usually think like, which one brought me to tears? Which one made me...
That would be Away From Her.
Which one moved me, you know, that much? Uh-huh. Neither one of these really move me that much as far as like make me feel the tears that are in the movie. Neither one of them has a lot of that.
Yeah, neither is a teary emotional movie by any means.
But usually that kind of gives something an extra boost for me because of how emotional of a guy I am.
But There Will Be Blood. It's not emotional in a... you know, crying sense, but I mean, it's really visceral.
They're both tragedy, and you know, tragedy is going to have, you know, historically, that's what it's.
But just those horror elements and the scoring, and there's just that dread and sort of anxiety that just pumps through the thing at all times. So, I mean, that movie kind of made me uncomfortable in a way that felt intentional.
Yes.
From Paul Thomas Anderson, and No Country. I was kind of more of an outsider on that experience.
Okay. I can understand that. The visceral part, I definitely agree with. Although again, when you have, Llewellyn Moss, Josh Brolin sitting in that hotel room waiting with his gun aimed at the door.
Yeah.
Those kind of Hitchcockian quasi jump scare kind of, suspense tricks, they work really well. The Coen brothers do it really well.
The craft is there, no doubt about it. It's just used in a very, very different way than There Will Be Blood. But we're talking about these two. So my question kind of has to do with a trend this year. Okay. So 2007, kind of a weirdly huge year for Westerns. Postmodern Westerns, they're not the traditional Westerns, although 310 to Yuma also came out this year.
I didn't get around to that one. Did you
I'd seen it before. I saw it in theater, and
I actually have it, and I just never got to watch it.
Yeah, I don't think it would have been a true contender for you.
I don't think so either, but...
But still interesting that you have 310 to Yuma, which is kind of a straight up, you know, we're bringing the Western back kind of thing. And then No Country, There Will Be Blood, more of postmodern entries, and also Jesse James. So you have... four pretty big titles from the year that are kind of bringing back a seemingly dead genre. You know, they're all about lawlessness and open spaces and, you know, molding a world. There are no, even though there are no cowboys and horses really in any of them.
You don't call Jesse James a cowboy on there?
He's Jesse James hat? is kind of the clearest. Well, 310 to Yuma is the clearest.
Yeah, true.
Cowboy Western. Jesse James has them. In No Country, Tommy Lee Jones, he does have a horse.
He does.
That's something. And There Will Be Blood looks like a Western. I mean, it has that going for
it. He rides with his son on the horse to go up to the quail hunt.
Yeah, it's about prospecting for oil, which is kind of...
Not on the quail hunt, though. They walked on foot.
Yeah. Anyway, so all of that. So it got me thinking. There's a resurgence going on in 2007 about Westerns. Is it possible in our current market, which 15 years in the future... Doesn't seem like that much, but it's a very different movie market now than it was in 2007. Is it possible to have another resurgence, and what would that genre be, do you think?
Well, the whole time you're talking about that, I was thinking of Power of the Dog, which is another kind of postmodern
Western is one we just keep coming back
Western,
to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as far as like what's a new genre, I mean, I think that really... The big thing that's going on is how can we push and pull on the superhero? That's a big trend, you know. The Batman in 2022 was I think, kind of a little departure from the other Batman movies to some extent. I mean, we're about to get to Dark Knight, which is really what set that off. But and Iron Man came out in 08.
08, yeah.
So that's kind of the, I think, the beginning of a new era
For sure. Yeah.
Superhero movies, but
Spider-Man was kind of planting the seeds.
Yeah, it did.
But 2008, Iron Man comes out and the MCU really goes for it.
Yeah, Tobey Maguire and those Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi trilogy, definitely deserve a lot of credit for you know, beginning of it. But I don't know. What do you see? I don't really watch a lot of the current stuff, you know, because
So what do you see? I was thinking about this, and I think that horror comes to mind immediately just because always that works in cycles, you know? So it's kind of like slashers will be huge for a while in the 80s, and then they'll get so cliche and tired that they go away for a bit and they come back, you know, Scream brings them back or something like that. But if you kind of put horror aside, I was thinking about Marvel, just like you brought up, and sci-fi and action movies and kind of where they fit. And I kind of think that...
Not seeing a lot of sci-fi actually either.
That's the thing. I think that Disney kind of has the market cornered right now because we're getting a new Star Wars show like every few months. We get a new Marvel movie every few months, it seems. And they're all huge. You know, every action movie now needs to be this spectacle, this big event, 2.5 hours long, mega budget.
At least 2.5.
Yeah, I mean, the Batman was a gentleman's 3 hours.
250 would be better.
Yeah. But I don't know if there is space to have a mid-budget movie anymore, like a mid-budget thriller, like a Speed. Speed popped in my head today. Do you think that if Speed came out today, it would probably be a $100 million movie and they would make the cars transform into robots? You know, like there would be something else to it that would make it a spectacle. And what I think is really interesting about it is you get these kind of postmodern entries into the genre, even while the genre is still at its peak, like superhero movies. You have like Logan is one, and WandaVision on TV. Those were two that kind of played with the form. And The Boys, that's on Prime, is another example of like, here's this really popular thing, let's kind of flip it on its head and, you know, comment on it. But that's not a resurgence. That's kind of just piggybacking on what's going on right now. Mm-hmm. So in order for this to kind of come back in a different form, first it has to go away. And I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, seems like the comic book superhero stuff. I mean, everything just keeps making money. That's what's going to determine it, or if there's some outside force besides money, but that's usually all it needs.
Yeah, the movies need to be bigger and bigger and bigger, and everything in between gets pushed to streaming or is made into a TV show. So it'll just get to the point where are people tired of seeing 3-hour movies and they kind of want to return to the 2-hour mid-budget one?
Have you seen Maverick?
No, I haven't.
It's a Tom Cruise movie. I don't know if you've...
He's the actor? Okay.
So, you know, that one was clearly like, it's another one where at the beginning you get to the theater and it's like Tom Cruise is sitting there on a couch.
Oh, and he talks to you.
Thank you so much for coming to the theater. We made this for you.
For you. Oh, that's so nice of him.
It is. And of course, there's a lot of moans and groans in the audience when he did that. But I took him at his word.
Yeah.
But I don't think it has to be a superhero movie,
but it's still a mega blockbuster.
But that one to feel like, how are we going to get people there? We're going to pay $11,000 per minute to get these people in actual fighter jets and pay the Navy, to be landing on these aircraft and all that stuff. You have to do something that makes you feel like, why does this have to be on a big screen? And so whether it's creating the spectacle, I would hope that there are big spectacles that are practical also, not just special effects.
Yeah.
And that one was
pretty, and Maverick's one of them.
Yeah, that was pretty fun to see.
And sci-fi, you brought up also, Dune and Blade Runner 2049 are two more examples where they aren't owned by Disney, unless Disney's, you know, eventually got some other, you know, umbrella going
soon
on
enough,
there.
They will.
But
be.
They're also these like massively long and expensive spectacle blockbusters. They're not just like some upstart.
Speaking of,
and they're properties that already either came out before, or they're established in some kind of way. It's not a new idea.
Yeah. Speaking of Dune, I believe, was Philip Seymour Hoffman in the original Dune? I think he had a small role.
I don't remember.
I was reading up. I was reading about Philip Seymour Hoffman because of my question. Philip Seymour Hoffman made three pretty great movies this year. The Savages, great performance. Stop doing that with your head. No.
I don't know if they're great, but
his performances are great, in my opinion. Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Savages, Before the Devil
Knows You're Dead.
I thought he was great in that.
Yeah, he is.
And
Charlie Wilson's War.
And Charlie Wilson's War, which he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for that. You could have given him that nomination for any of those three. And that's pretty... Anyway, that was very impressive.
So they picked the biopic.
The Oscar one.
Who would have thought?
The Tom Hanks one.
Yeah.
If you're in something with Tom Hanks, you get extra credit.
I guess so.
So anyway, I was looking, reading up on Philip Seymour Hoffman a little bit. He died in 2014, by the way. So when he was in The Talented Mr. Ripley, kind of before he got really big.
He was in his character actor stage
yes.
then.
And I mean, honestly, did that ever really go away? Like he went from character actor to supporting actor to main actor, but not in like, you know, he was never like the big star in like a blockbuster. He's always kind of like a character actor as the main. I don't know.
Yeah, in The Master, he's kind of the lead.
Yeah, that's true. But was that a blockbuster? I don't know.
No.
It's PTA, but... But anyway, after Talented Mr. Ripley, apparently Meryl Streep took notice of him and said this. This actor is fearless. He's done what we all strive for. He's given this awful character the respect he deserves, and he's made him fascinating. The National Board of Review named him the best supporting actor that year for Talented Mr. Ripley and Magnolia the same year. Is that really true? Magnolia and
99.
Okay, yeah. I thought Ripley was a little earlier than that, but so my question is that the definition of great acting? I mean, do you agree with Meryl Streep? Does she know what she's talking about?
I should hope so.
She said that he gave this awful character the respect he deserves.
Hmm. It's an interesting way to put it, and I guess that she's right, that no matter who you're playing, you need to understand the person enough to play him as if he's a human and not like a mustache-twirling bad guy, you know? That's where the empathy
bad
is.
Guy.
A gentleman's bad guy, yeah. Yeah, martini in hand.
Did Javier Bardem give Anton Chigurh the respect he deserves?
That's an interesting question.
Does Anton Chigurh deserve respect? Did Anthony Hopkins give Hannibal Lecter the respect he deserves?
For sure. So I guess Bardem does too, because that kind of puts it in context, I think, for me, where respect at least is commanding of your attention whenever he's on screen.
Okay.
You know, rather than I respect this guy as a person and his choices.
Would I like to have dinner with Hannibal Lecter?
It's more that you're making the part count. And when that guy's on screen, there's an impact. And you sort of remember him for the next few frames of the next scene.
He's made him fascinating. That's what Meryl Streep said about Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. I also think about Daniel Day-Lewis here.
Mm-hmm.
An awful character. Given the respect he deserves. See, I would say, what respect does Anton Chigurh really deserve? I don't know, but I think that Daniel Day-Lewis's character deserves certain respect that if you only listed off what he does on paper, you would think deserves no respect. But somehow in the way they're portrayed, you see him as a real person that if you have some empathy, which maybe neither he nor Anton Chigurh had, but you're understanding something about humanity because of the way they're portraying these people.
Mm-hmm.
Philip Seymour Hoffman's characters, when he's angry, he's the most fun actor to watch.
Yeah.
Watching him explode in rage, like, there's nothing better than Philip Seymour Hoffman like that.
I remember the opening of Mission Impossible 2, I think. Mm-hmm. It might be 3.
I think it's 3.
I think it's 3, where it's sort of in the airplane and the camera's kind of jostling that's not around.
I think 2 is the one where Philip Seymour Hoffman is like, basically has Tom Cruise. I forget which one. It's 2 or 3.
Yeah, it's 2. It's 2 or 3. It doesn't really matter.
We all know the fourth one, but 2 and 3 get mixed up.
Yeah. All I remember from the movie is that opening sequence where he just is such an intense bad guy. And you know right from the start, like, this is a scary guy. Mm-hmm. And he pushes Tom Cruise out of a plane or something like that. And then the rest of the movie doesn't really matter so much. He's not really on screen all that much. So it's like, you know, he leaves that imprint.
But Tom Cruise gives Ethan Hunt the respect he deserves.
He does, yes.
Trivia. I watched The Namesake. I liked it quite a bit. It's not in my top 5, but I liked it a lot. Cal Penn is the actor who plays the teenager who eventually becomes, you know, a 30-something-year-old. So he was offered a part, Cal Penn was, in Planet Terror.
Nice, okay.
The Robert Rodriguez segment of Grindhouse, which I did not see, but he turned it down because of conflicts doing The Namesake.
Ah, bummer.
You like that?
Yeah, I mean, I wish he would have been in both. I mean, that's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
So Cal Penn, The Namesake was his favorite book. He used to check into hotels under the pseudonym of Gogol Ganguly. Mm. Ganguly?
I think it's Ganguly.
The lead character in the book. And then when he found out that Meera Nair, who's kind of like a legendary Bollywood, you know, director, when he found out that she was making a movie out of it, he basically talked her into letting him do that role, even though she already had somebody figured out for that role. Mm. So I thought that was pretty cool. Jhumpa Lahiri is the author of The Namesake, the novel. It came out in 2003. It was originally published as a story in The New Yorker, then it was expanded to a full-length novel. I have not read that. I think I read the story, not the novel, but I did read her Pulitzer Prize winning short story collection, Interpreter of Maladies, which deals with a lot of the same themes of, I don't know, what do you think of the multi-generational aspect of that movie?
I think the parent story is definitely better than Cal Penn's. I think the second half of the movie is a little weaker, and that's what kept it out of my top list also this year. When I saw it for the first time, I guess back in 2007.
It was a gentleman's 5.
It was. I was convinced, like, this is a perfect movie. And I loved it. And this time around, I still think it's pretty great.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a pretty swift drop off when we move away from those parents. And
isn't
then
it all Cal Penn's fault? I feel
like his acting performance, you think, is what ruins it?
Yes.
Like, I think it's more has to do with the writing. As and him, the dissolution of his marriage happens very quickly. And then when he's with his girlfriend, they break up. That doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
But I think it's more the acting. The writing, I mean, Jhumpa Lahiri is great. She is like a, I don't know, modern master, but she's really great. I think Cal Penn kind of ruins it. Sorry, Cal. He's been in a lot of things, a lot of like TV shows, done voice work a lot since then. He actually worked in the Obama administration also.
Really?
Yeah. Like in their communications office.
That's awesome.
Anyway. Okay. So 2007, these are the movies that made, according to Metacritic, people's top movies of the decade lists. Okay, so I always think that's interesting to see not just what was great that year, but what eventually stood the test of time, at least somewhat, for the decade. Mm-hmm. So There Will Be Blood had the most, you know, appeared on the most and had the most first places of the decade.
Okay.
So that's kind of like a pretty clear, you know, stamp of approval that the critics at least saw this as the staying powerest movie of the decade. No Country for Old Men was like right behind it. So again, 2 from the same year, right up there. There's only 3 others that were on multiple lists.
Okay. Can I guess?
Yes.
Paranormal Activity.
Incorrect.
Super Bad.
Not even close.
Knocked Up.
Not even close.
So that's I'm not done guessing.
That's the rest of your top 5.
Hot Fuzz.
Incorrect.
I don't know. I was trying to think of just culturally relevant movies.
No, none of these are. No, the Diving Bell and the Butterfly was on.
And what is the name of this list again?
This is the Metacritic, just gathering all the, like, it was like, I don't know, 100 different critics.
Mm-hmm.
What are their top tens of the decade? And then you just compile them all and see like which ones showed up on the most.
Okay.
I think that's a really.
So by critics, and yes, we're not talking about viewers or cultural
it's
relevance
just,
at all.
Okay, just what critics included them on their top 10 list of the decade.
Okay.
So There Will Be Blood, No Country. The Diving Bell and the Butterfly was like number 17 as far as getting, you know, you get this many points for being number one and whatever. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Ratatouille.
Yeah.
And Zodiac. Those are the three that made. So I don't know if to me, that's one way of saying the critics believe, you know, in hindsight that those were the five best movies of the year.
Mm-hmm.
That would be one way to say it.
Yeah, I could see that.
Interesting list. So one thing I was curious about is Ratatouille.
Yeah.
I did not rewatch it. What's your take on animated movies? How come you don't ever include them in your top fives? What's the problem? It's a gentleman's two?
No. I am a fan, but they usually don't cross over into movies I'm like super stoked about and want to tell people to watch. Ratatouille.
You're not like making Facebook recommendations, calling your friends. Did you guys see Ratatouille?
No.
Why not?
But I mean, there are some that cross over, like Up. One of my favorites. I watched it recently.
All the way through or just the first 10 minutes?
No. All the way through. I mean, the first 10 minutes is the best part of the movie, but all the way through. And I remember I just kind of popped in when Charlotte was watching it one day. And I'm like, oh, I'll just watch this for like 5 minutes. And I ended up staying for the entire thing. Because I'm like, this movie rules.
Meanwhile, Charlotte's gone.
She's gone. Yeah. I kept shushing her, you know? But I'm a fan and... I guess I'm just they don't leave as much of a mark, but I do find that I like them more now than I did when I was younger and I was like, everything has to be edgy. Like that was kind of my criteria from high school on. You know, it's kind of softened a little bit.
I'm glad you see the errors of some of your ways. So I've watched now two movies from 08. Three actually.
Okay.
Cheating into 08 already.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was WALL-E.
Yeah.
And I remember being blown away by the first of WALL-E.
Yeah, same.
Loved every little detail. It's genius. And then I kind of like fizzle out. Eevee is good, not great. Going up to the spaceship with all the fat blobs on the recliners. Like, I don't even know what the plot is.
Wasn't it just like exercise and recycle? Wasn't that the point?
But I fell asleep the first time I watched it because I was like, I so tuned out. It was probably a conscious falling asleep.
Uh-huh. You know? You're like, I'm done here.
And then we watched it last night. And I fell asleep in like the same exact part of the movie.
Really?
Hmm. And I have no desire to watch the rest of this movie. It's not going to make my list. Although, I don't know, do I count that in the movies I watched this year since I only watched about 60%?
I mean, you've seen it before.
Does it count? No, I've never seen it all the way through.
Oh, you'd never seen it all the way
through? I fell asleep the first time, and I fell asleep the second time.
Oh, okay.
So should I even count that on my list?
I mean, me personally, I wouldn't count it. If I'm not watching all the way to the credits, then I can't go on Letterboxd.
What about the post-credits?
Yeah, we've talked about this. I don't do that. I don't watch those. I've got a life to live. I'm not sitting around for 10 minutes and watching credits.
Okay, so a couple other ones. I did a little bit of research on Diving Bell. It was originally to be produced by Universal, and the screenplay was all in English. Johnny Depp. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Johnny Depp was supposed to be Booby or Bobby, however you pronounce his name. Kind of interesting. Anyway, they decided to go all French and Johnny Depp decided to go off and make Pirates at World's End instead.
Ugh.
Max von Sydow is in, Diving Bell. I think it's a great performance. I mean, the father who has his son, you know, become, paralyzed and he does a great job playing a really old guy. you know.
Well, he's been around a really long time.
He has indeed. But, you know, the shaving scene, you know, his son is shaving him. And it's, anyway, so here's a great tidbit from Max von Sydow, who, by the way, died in March of 2020 at age 90. In 2012, he told Charlie Rose, it's been a while since we brought up Charlie Rose.
Yeah.
I used to watch.
He was a frequent flyer.
I used to watch a Charlie Rose video interview with almost every movie in the early days of this episode or the show. So he was going to be in an Ingmar Bergman movie, decided that he held out for more money. Didn't make it, it didn't work out. And then he was in another one later. So anyway, he knew Ingmar Bergman. He told Charlie Rose, Max von Sydow did. And von Sydow, he's either an agnostic or atheist. So they would debate, you know, that'd be a great conversation to hear, wouldn't it? Max von Sydow debating the afterlife with Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah.
Ingmar Bergman apparently told him that he would contact Max von Sydow after death to show him that there was a life after death.
So he'll haunt him.
So Charlie Rose asked von Sydow, have you heard from Bergman? And he said, yes, I have. So he wanted more details, and he declined to give further details.
Hmm.
So he said that he has been a doubter since his youth, Max von Sydow has, but that his doubt is gone, and he came to agree with Bergman's belief in the afterlife. I mean, we got to know what that visitation was all about.
Why wouldn't he say?
He was all in black. Max von Sydow was playing chess.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, I got it.
So anyway, that's my trivia.
It's good. That's good. I don't, it kind of is annoying that he wouldn't just say what his experience is.
Come on.
It's a little questionable if you ask me. It puts the whole thing under suspicion.
But he's a believer now.
I think we got to get into our top fives.
I think we do.
So, full disclosure, my list is not filled out.
Mike, come on.
My top two, and I think
you've
my three.
You've had months of 07 pondering, and you're going to wimp out on this?
I'm going to pick.
This is terrible.
But I've got a page open with my favorites uh-huh. on Letterboxd so that, you're
gonna
that I'm looking at.
You're going to just do a blind.
I'm going to keep my eyes open. But I'm going to pick,
there's no pressure on this. I mean, that's the whole point of these lists. They change. How many of those
people. It's a living, breathing document, the top five. There's no doubt about that.
How many of these, it's like Peter Travers putting There Will Be Blood as number seven in 07 mm-hmm. and then number one of the decade.
Yeah.
It makes zero sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
But so that's how I feel like There Will Be Blood. Am I sliding There Will Be Blood that it's number two? No, because next month I'll watch it again and it'll go up to number one. It's like yeah. Citizen Kane and Casablanca. They just always are jockeying for position in my heart for number one.
Understandable. But I've got the 4.5 star situation here and I've got a bunch of them.
You can't betray your Letterboxd fans.
I can't betray them. So I think for my number five, I think I'm going to land on Away From Her for my number five. Mm-hmm. This is one that...
You think you're going to, or that is officially... For the record keeping of BPT lore, this is it.
My official number five is Away From Her. Mm-hmm. And this is another, like There Will Be Blood, mm-hmm. that I just loved the second time around. The first time, kind of admired it at a distance. This time, I was just locked in the whole time. And there's something to that. And maybe that's just recency bias where I watched it in the right mood on the right day and it clicked with me. But I guess you gotta be true to that emotional experience, you know? My number four, I'm going to go campy. I'm going The Mist for my number four.
Number four?
I'm going to go with The Mist as my number four here.
Wow.
The rest of my list is too classy and I needed to get some dirt under my fingernails here. So that's what The Mist is
doing.
Some
dried blood.
It's grunging up the gentleman on this list.
Some bug guts.
Yeah. If you give me bug guts and an ending like that, you're going to end up
on
my list.
So tell me this. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Mist ending, disturbing and just shocking. I was like, that's an ending.
Yeah.
But is that enough? Is the rest of it that good?
That's not just it. I loved this the first time I saw it, and I loved it just as much this time. It didn't go down. It didn't go up. It was just level.
It was number four from the day that you watched it.
It does a similar thing that No Country does in avoiding pretty much all music except for at the very end.
That's because it was low budget, but yeah, go ahead.
Whatever the reason, I mean, I'm sure that they could have gotten some cheap music on there, but he chose not to, and that just adds a weight to it. And I love this idea of, like, usually a disaster movie, we see the disaster, but this is kind of like the quiet spaces in between when everyone's yeah. realizing, like, life as I know it is over, and now how do we cope, and what do we do, and there's the breakdown of civilization there.
That's the name of the movie that we're going to write, Quiet Space.
Kind of close to A Quiet Place.
Well, by the time we actually write this, everyone people, will have forgotten
people
about
will
it.
Have forgotten about oh, yeah. that. That makes sense. My number three, The Assassination of Jesse James by really? The coward wow. Robert Ford. I'm going to put it as my number three.
Okay.
Just because I think maybe not only one of the most unique movies of the year, mm-hmm. but one of the most unique movies that we've done on the show so far. Casey Affleck's performance. Come on. Roger Deakins cinematography.
Yep.
Give me a break.
And then, you're trying to convince me.
Yes, this should be your number three. If it's not already, you should move it up.
Okay, you got it. I just moved it.
But also that sort of poetic narration that I know you were on the fence about.
Yeah.
You weren't really sure.
So to convince me of that, why did you like that?
I think why I liked it was if you're gonna go so postmodern with the Western,
yeah.
then we're accepting right away that we're not watching a Western play out in real time. We're reflecting back and we're looking back at a different time. And we're looking back at like what it means to mythologize a time and a place and a person. And this movie is kind of about fame and anti-heroes. And if you build all that in, there's like, I don't know, there's like a romance already built into this idea that like some people are different than the rest of us. Like Jesse James, there's a line in there that says something like, you know, if he walks into a room, clocks move slower mm-hmm. and, you know, your temperature goes up a little bit. That's a great line. Mm-hmm. It's a great line. And it just goes to show that like, that's how we feel about movie stars nowadays. You know, that we talk about movie star charisma sometimes and like Daniel Day-Lewis might be making this really odd choice in There Will Be Blood, but because he's so talented, that weird choice that most actors would look ridiculous doing, it works for him, and it just
the
makes
limp,
the thing
the hobbling through the
yeah
the big
it just
boots.
It gives his character an extra edge, and it draws us closer to the screen. And I think that movie is kind of exploring that push and pull.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, There Will Be Blood with Daniel Day-Lewis. I've been asked every time my daughter has asked me a few times recently, like, "What's your favorite this or what's your favorite that?" Sorry, Kennedy, that sounded like I was mocking your tone of voice, cause I wasn't. But she'll say like, "What is your favorite color?" And I'll be like, "I don't have a favorite color. I like all of them. I like all the colors." And I'm like, I'm so sad that no one in my family,
they like, can't relate
to your
impression.
They don't like this movie.
You would be my competitor. If they did do an impression, they would be your competitor. So I don't know if you want that.
There's that one. And then from at the dinner table, it's like whenever somebody says, "Can you pass the salt?" I'm like, "Aubrey, could I trouble you for the salt, Master and Commander?" Anyway, so that's your number three. And then just like Peter Travers, who swapped his movies between 07 and the decade, you have now swapped your top one and two. Is that correct?
I haven't. It's still No Country
Recency
for Old Men.
Recency bias.
But I will say that this, and you, I think you mentioned this at the top of the show, this and There Will Be Blood, I love looking at them as companion pieces. And I think that for 2007, they are the standout movies of the year. And I love looking at them in, you know, comparing and contrasting the two. They were shot in the same place. They're both these sort of non-traditional Westerns in totally different styles.
Legendary directors
mm-hmm.
that people are like dying to work for.
Yes.
Great actors. They both have just tremendous soundtracks. Well, you know.
Yeah.
Except for No
Soundtrack
Country for
Old Men. Silence. But that just goes to show too, like how much power a strong vision can have. And you know, when you have the kind of craft that the Coens do or PTA, man, you can focus on the same space and just make a mountain range look look and feel so different
you can't,
in one frame than another.
I think that the main factor that made, really in hindsight, that makes me put No Country over There Will Be Blood, as much as I hate to cast aspersions in any way at There Will Be Blood, is that cashew scene. I love the memes. You know, the quarter.
You're going to measure in memes?
Yeah. Like, which one has the most memes out of it?
Spider-Man, then. I guess that would be at the top of every list, right? You get the three Spider-Mans looking at each other.
That's true.
I mean, that's a pretty big one. And There Will Be Blood, looking back at 2007, which I keep saying is just such a packed, great year, this is definitely the movie that I'm sort of most excited to watch again.
To rewatch, yeah.
And that was kind of my main criterion. That's what it all came down to for putting it as my number one. I watched it under bad conditions, and I was like,
that's true. You watched it with like bad sound or something like that.
The video was bad. The sound was bad, and that was all.
And it still made number one. Imagine if you had like 4K.
Seriously, I gotta get the Blu-ray, and it's gonna be maybe a gentleman's five star at that point. But I just kind of felt like
4.5.
I put it as a 4.5. Yeah.
Are you gonna change that? I mean,
if I watch it the next time and I have that feeling in my heart,
so we gotta wait for that.
I love it, but I'm not willing to say that this is a movie I 100% love.
So is this gonna be in your top five of the decade list?
You know what? I'm gonna say no as of right now. I could be swayed, but probably not.
Fascinating. But in your top 10?
My favorite PTA is still Punch Drunk Love. I'll say that.
Man, Punch Drunk Love. I was thinking how, you know, these seem to be... in a way, I think that those two movies are like a lock for my top five. But then you look back at Punch Drunk Love, Eternal Sunshine... It starts to get pretty crowded pretty quick up there.
It does.
Those are the two that we agreed on. The whole decade. We've only agreed on two movies, right? As the number one?
I think.
Punch Drunk Love and Eternal Sunshine.
You might be right, yeah.
Synecdoche, New York, by the way. I have...
That's another one where he's a leading man.
That's true.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I have such high expectations for this movie that it is going to be almost impossible... For
bad,
the movie to reach
to, go in.
To live up to what I want.
You should start telling yourself
how horrible
it's going to be a slog.
But so Synecdoche, New York, it's the next movie by Charlie Kaufman. Mm-hmm. I held up the movie. I got it from the library the other day, and there's like some scratches on it, so I'm already scared.
Oh boy!
But I held it up to my wife. I was like, "Being John Malkovich, adaptation, Eternal Sunshine." Synecdoche, New York. You know, I'm like shouting.
Mm-hmm. Well, you often yell at your wife.
In enthusiastic terms.
But he didn't direct all those. That's the thing.
I know. Now he directed it. Roger Ebert put this as his number one of the year.
Okay.
He's
of 08, you're talking about?
Of 08.
Okay.
So he's the only one who put it even on a list, period.
Wow.
And he put it as his number one. He also included it in his best movies of all time list. Like, he wanted a recent movie, and he put that one in. Anyway, we're going off to 08 now.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. So tell me your personal top five.
My personal top five. There are three that are kind of like jockeying to be up there that I'm going to give honorable mentions. It's actually a bunch of good honorable mentions, but I'm going to give three. One is The Savages. Apparently, you did not like this as much as I did.
This was one that I liked more the first time in 07. And this time around, I thought, yeah, okay.
I actually liked it more this time around.
Interesting.
Laura Linney was nominated. Philip Seymour Hoffman could have been nominated. I'm a sucker for movies that have struggling writers in them.
You are.
And Laura Linney is definitely one. I love the sibling, you know, the disagreements that also are, you know, very lovey-dovey at the end. It's a little too tidy at the end. That's probably one of the big reasons it didn't make my top five. Mm-hmm. I really, really liked American Gangster. Another one maybe we disagree on. I think it's shot beautifully. The long shots with such detail and interesting, the depth in a lot of the shots, it's repeated over and over again. And I think that it's just masterfully shot. And Denzel Washington. I'm a sucker for Denzel Washington. Michael Clayton is also not in my top five, but it's surprisingly up there, and I was close. So my number five is The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. We've already talked about it. If you haven't seen it, highly recommend it. We didn't do a bonus episode on it, but Janusz Kaminski is nominated. Amazing cinematography, putting you in the eyeball, that stark, open, way too wide eyeball of the main character. But yeah, it was mesmerizing. I was not expecting it to be there. It was kind of a later addition, but Away From Her is my number four.
Nice.
We've talked about that at length. We had a bonus episode. Atonement is my number three. Same. We've done a bonus episode on that. I'm a sucker for Keira Knightley. You know, she gets me every time I see her on screen. And Joe Wright's daring, you know, style, I just really like. There Will Be Blood, and then my number one is No Country, which, who knows, that could flip any moment. So, Oscar kicks.
Before we do that, I want to list some honorables
because
I think this is the first year where I might just say whatever.
Oh, no.
Top 15. Instead of a top 10.
Okay.
I might just do a top 15 and include, because there are so many here that I love.
Well, so, if you do your top 15 and you order them, that means that number 11 is going to not be in your top 10. I just want to make
true.
That clear.
As of right now, my number 11 is Michael Clayton.
Oh, okay.
So
that was closer to like number 5 or 6, 7 for me. So anyway.
The 6 through 10 in no particular order, I put Paranormal Activity. Mm-hmm. Such a huge impact. I feel like it has to be in there.
But impact has nothing to do with your personal top 10.
I really like Paranormal Activity, but it's you know, it's such a low rent movie that
the acting is just not good.
Yeah, that's part of it. what it does for the genre, I love. But if I'm just looking at it in comparison to those other ones, maybe The Mist being the one exception, it clearly isn't of the same quality. So that's why I don't have it in my five. Bug, also loved a lot. Mm-hmm. We talked about that in our sort of roundup episode. And one we didn't talk about at all is Superbad. Mm-hmm. I know that you hate comedies because you don't like joy or laughter, but Superbad was one that I had an awesome time with in the theater and didn't get a chance to revisit. But if I did and I liked it as much, it might have pushed out The Mist.
Really?
And maybe been my five.
But Mist was four.
Yeah.
So it would have been four bumping out Away From Her.
I'm just kind of projecting that I might have just moved Away From Her as my number four and slid Superbad in as my five. I don't know how it would have worked out. And then Wreck and Grindhouse for my other two that are kind of the horror movies from the year that I love. I feel like 2007 was kind of a resurgence year for horror, and Wreck is one of the most actually scary zombie movies I think I've ever seen. Hmm. And Grindhouse is very imperfect, but just bold and crazy. And when I saw it for the first time, I was like, you can do this? Like, they could make a double feature of two weirdo movies that nobody's going to see except for like me and some of my weirdo friends. And they did. And it lost a ton of money, but I'm so glad that it exists.
So glad they lost that money.
I don't care about them. They're doing fine. But then also Hot Fuzz and Once were two that...
I didn't get around to Once.
Once is another super low budget movie, but it relies on sort of music. Like, how do you build a song and just the power of a good song? So it's kind of my favorite musical, even though that's cheating because it's not really a musical, but music fills out most of the thing. So
I was surprised by how much I enjoyed The Namesake and Charlie Wilson's War. Mm-hmm. Charlie Wilson's War I saw once before and thought, oh man, this is a yawner. I don't know what it was, but this time around I was more enthralled with it. Mm-hmm. So that would be in my top 10, Charlie Wilson's War.
Okay.
I liked Zodiac. I don't know what it was. It's just like too long or it's a little anticlimactic somehow, but
I think we're in the minority on that one.
I know.
Because when I saw it for the first time, I had a very similar reaction that I felt like it was a little too long and a little too slow and I didn't really connect with it emotionally and then I didn't rewatch it.
Robert Downey Jr. is supposed to get awesomer throughout the movie, not, you know, become more of a loser during the movie. That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
Okay, Oscar kicks. First off, mm-hmm. I love Javier Bardem in No Country, but Casey Affleck should have won for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah.
Tommy Lee Jones, he's fine in The Valley of Eli. But Denzel Washington should have gotten nominated for American Gangster. I liked Juno. It's not in my top 10, but I would much rather see Joe Wright in there for best director as opposed to Jason Reitman for directing Juno. And the last one,
I agree with that.
Although, first of all, Roger Deakins nominated 2 times.
Mm-hmm.
No Country and Jesse James are both his movies. Robert Elswit won for There Will Be Blood. It's brilliant. I mean, what a year for cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
But Janusz Kaminski for Diving Bell and the Butterfly, I think, was even the best out of all those, which is saying a lot. But I like to be surprised. I like strange. Mm-hmm. I like playing with color and focus and composition and all of it. And the way that they... I mean, that movie is all about one guy's perspective when he can just, he's paralyzed and he can see with one eye and that's it. And they put you in his eye.
Yeah.
I mean, it's astounding. And then they throw in these like weird, like fantasy type shots where he's like sitting on a platform in the middle of the ocean, you know, and it makes no sense, but, and you know, he's looking where he's looking, you know, that you're in his point of view. I just think, it's a marvel. So I would, even though I love Roger Deakins and Robert Elswit's work in those movies, I would put Janusz Kaminski. He also directed Munich in the previous, I don't know, it was last year or the year before that, but tremendous work there too. Any of your
I can't disagree. Picks? Atonement and Diving Bell are kind of the two most obvious cinematography first movies. But I agree. I mean, the only thing I think I might add to the conversation is Elliot Page lost the leading actress role, and I'm not so sure. She lost to Marion
Cotillard, though.
Cotillard.
But La Vie en Rose, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. I didn't love the movie. It's kind of hard to watch, but... I didn't have any beefs with her winning best actress.
It comes back to that sort of iconic, creating an iconic character and how hard that is. And it is such a rare thing that I want that recognition for Juno, even though I don't really care about recognizing anything else about Juno. So I guess maybe I'm just trying to shoehorn in something to give Juno
some way
some
to give
props.
Her some props.
Yeah.
I thought Elliot Page, that role was good. You know, I felt like the most impressive acting was like the crying scene in the van. It almost felt a little bit forced in the
you like the big the emotions. You like the tears.
I do. I love the tears.
So next episode, we're starting on new feet.
Ben Button.
We're starting 2008.
Old Ben.
And I think it's going to be tough to live up to the quality of 2007.
It certainly will.
But we'll start with Benjamin Button and see where we go from there.
Brad Pitt is really old and really young.
And Cate Blanchett is just about the same age all the way through. Until then, you can find us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you listen. We're also on social media. And for 16 years of Golden Takes, head over to Letterboxd.com/Mike Cavalieri.
To support the show, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. Also, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe.
Until next time, remember, best movie of 07, No Country for Old Men.
There will be blood.